You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, back to school for university students often involves a lot of parties and often a lot of drinking. We'll talk to a dean at UW-Stout about a new program to fight high-risk drinking off campus.
First, the long simmering debate about free-roaming cats and the damage they can do to birds and native species just got a little more intense. The book Cat Wars comes out today, calling for a future free of all free-ranging cats.
The arguments to rein in feral cats and keep house cats indoors go something like this. Outdoor cats kill birds and other native species, according to some studies, in vast numbers, and roaming cats die earlier than house cats. On the other side, some advocates for letting their cats out will say cats can kill rodents. That means less rat poisoning, better controlled pest populations. Cats, they're wired to hunt. They're happier if they're allowed outside and less prone to obesity if they get outside.
Stanley Temple and his students have studied the impact of free-ranging cats on wildlife in rural Wisconsin. He's the Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and a Senior Fellow of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Stan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, why is the debate about the effects of free-roaming cats such a heated one? You were mentioning right before we went on the air that this is something that's kind of haunted you throughout your professional career. When you're on the radio like this, you get hate mail sometimes.
Well, the whole issue is rather surprising in a number of respects. Here in the U.S. and in most countries around the world, it's generally accepted that if you own a domestic animal, you do not allow that domestic animal to roam freely. We don't let dogs roam free. We don't let our horses roam free and so on. It seems to be somewhat different here in the U.S., but it's also rather surprising to me, and has been ever since my professional career intersected with cats, of what an emotional issue this is, especially with two camps, people who are, I would say, very fond of cats and don't like to see or hear anything negative said about cats. And on the other side, people who see cats as a very harmful, invasive species that does harm to native wildlife.
And it seems to me from the outside of this that it's getting more intense and higher profile. I'm thinking about Jonathan Franzen's novel Freedom, where one of the main characters is this guy who's on this crusade to stop cats from going outside. A major novel, a major novelist, and it seems as though the debate keeps getting more intense. So what do you think? Do you see it being something that we haven't resolved, so it keeps intensifying?
No, I think that's absolutely right. It has gotten more intense, and to some extent that parallels the really phenomenal growth in the number of cats in the U.S. And going along with the increase in the total number of cats, of course, is an increase in the number of cats that are free-ranging. And free-ranging cats include a number of categories. In some places, a few warm places, there are truly feral cats that exist completely independent of humans. In a lot of places, there are sort of commensal cats that are not owned as pets but live in close association with people and depend on them for food and shelter. And then there are the owned pet cats that owners allow to free range, to go outside and range freely.
And I imagine that the owners of those pet cats, some of whom, you know, those cats go outside, are some of the people who are most concerned about. But how big a problem is that last category when you look at the bigger impact?
Well, we know some things about the numbers, and the numbers are pretty astounding. There are about 90 million owned pet cats in the U.S., and depending on the location where studies have been done, often somewhere in the neighborhood of a quarter to a third of those cats are allowed to free range. So we're talking about tens of millions of cats that free range. Our study here just in rural Wisconsin suggested that, much like many of the other studies that followed, that about a third of the owned pet cats in rural Wisconsin are allowed to free range.
And so what happened here in Wisconsin? This is something you studied with your students, and you got some interesting results, to say the least. So what did you find?
Well, our study was prompted by a growing concern about the conflict between free-ranging cats and conservation objectives. And what we looked at was several-fold. How many cats are out there in rural Wisconsin? And we focused on rural Wisconsin because those were the places where cats would have the most interactions with wildlife. And we found that there were at least 1.4 million free-ranging cats in Wisconsin. That included a lot of commensal cats, which here in Wisconsin we generally call barn cats, but it also included the pet cats that were allowed to free range. And we looked at what they killed, and we found that on average, each of those free-ranging cats killed at least 5.6 birds a year. And when you consider that there were 1.4 million of them out there, it adds up pretty quickly to 7.8 million birds that are killed every year just in rural Wisconsin by free-ranging cats.
And I'm sure cats don't discriminate. They're not just killing the grackles and the sparrows. Do you know what kinds of birds were impacted most severely when you talk about that?
We have a pretty good idea. It looks as though they target, as you might guess, ground-dwelling birds, so birds that nest and spend a lot of time on the ground. And here in Wisconsin, unfortunately, that includes a group of birds that are in big conservation trouble, and those are our grassland birds. And grassland birds don't have much native prairie left to live in, so they are mostly living in agricultural grasslands that, at least in Wisconsin, are close to rural homes and farmsteads where most of these rural cats exist.
And you're quoted heavily. There's a chapter that goes deeply into your research in this new book coming out today. It's called Cat Wars. And that author argues that he sees cats as an invasive species. Humans bring them in. The cats breed. They kill these vulnerable species. Do you agree with that argument?
I think I have to. As an ecologist, I know that people often think of cats as being somehow special. But indeed, as an ecologist, they fit the definition of an invasive species. They are not native in the area. They do go out into natural habitats and hunt and kill wildlife. So they have become invasive.
We're talking to Stanley Temple right now. His research is featured in the new book, Cat Wars. And we're talking about this debate over free-roaming cats and what kind of impact these cats have on the environment, conservation, and also whose decision it is to let a cat roam or not to let a cat roam. And Stanley, it seems like one sticking point here in the path to any sort of consensus about this is that sometimes these conversations seem like they could translate into an excuse to hate cats, and a lot of people really love cats, and I think those people worry that this kind of vitriol that can get stirred up could lead to cruelty. Do you worry about that?
I suppose you have to in a society as complex as ours. There certainly are people out there that don't like cats, and some portion of those people who don't like cats probably might feel inclined to do something that other people might consider to be cruel or unethical.
And if you look at the internet runs on cat videos. So obviously there's a portion of people who really love cats. I mean, dogs don't get this kind of hatred generally directed at them. But do you think there's a distinction there to be made between the way we feel about cats and the way we feel about dogs and the problems that both species could be a part of?
Well, it's interesting to go back 100 years, and the discussion in the U.S. really was about free-ranging dogs. And there was a societal pushback, if you will. It was prompted by concerns, in that case with dogs, about them killing wildlife, and rabies and diseases that could be spread to people and livestock. And indeed, it's exactly the same argument today. And 100 years ago, it was the debate over whether people should be allowed to let their dogs range free or whether they had to keep them under control. And I think society has pretty much decided that you cannot let your dog roam free. There are usually laws and regulations, leash laws, if you will, and keep your dog confined to your property. But we haven't gotten to that point with cats yet, so the debate still carries on.
Well, you and I had a little email conversation about this. The Washington Post ran an article that included the arguments that you outlined, that cats can harm some conservation objectives. But then they rounded up some animal experts who'd written books. And these people said, yes, I do care about, you know, conservation, and maybe I'm tortured about this a little bit, but I do let my cat roam. And a lot of them, just to round up what they said maybe the cats kill rats, or that the cats were happier outside. They were hardwired to hunt, and that it was actually good for these cats. They had less stress, less obesity. What do you think of those arguments?
Well, a few of those points may be valid, but the point is basically that the decision to allow cats to go outdoors is one that individuals make. And I would say that the individual humans who make that decision are individuals who are primarily concerned about that individual cat that they own. And they are quite different in their outlook on this issue from people who may like cats, but whose primary concern is about the welfare of wildlife species. And it's an interesting divide in a number of ways. It's a domestic animal versus wild animals. It's an individual animal versus populations of animals. So on a number of levels, it divides people in a very interesting sort of way. That's very difficult, actually, to find a bridge between these two, which is why the debate is so hot.
Well, we're talking right now about this debate, the debate over free-roaming cats, as a new book comes out today positioning cats as an invasive species. Stanley Temple is with us now. His research is featured in the book Cat Wars. He's professor emeritus in conservation in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Should it be up to the individual cat owner to decide if the cat goes outside? How serious should we be about curbing feral cats, neighborhood cats, keeping house cats indoors? Why do you think people are so passionate on this? If you own or are owned by a cat, do you keep that cat inside or let it roam wild and free? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're talking about the debate over free-roaming cats. There's a new book about the subject out just today. It's called Cat Wars, and it positions cats as an invasive species. Stanley Temple's with us now. His research on the effect of these free-roaming cats is featured in that book, Cat Wars. He's professor emeritus in conservation in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should people let their cats go outside? Do you let your cat go outside? Do you think the damage that cats do to wildlife is a big problem? Worth giving it up? Changing our societal attitudes toward cats? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We have Alan on the line in Viola. Alan, hi.
Hi. Yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just calling to say, you know, growing up out in the rurals, that, you know, we had some barn cats that would, you know, keep the rodents down and so forth on the barn, but my grandpa had a very strict policy that, you know, we would basically shoot any stray cats that would come onto our property. So we kind of had a few cats that would sort of roam, I guess you could say, but we also controlled any additional cats that came onto the property.
What was the thinking behind shooting the strays?
Well, again, it was basically to just have a set number of cats living on the property so that we didn't have so many cats that they were, you know, kind of overrunning the area.
All right. Well, thank you, Alan. And Alan's talking about those barn cats you were mentioning in Wisconsin. A lot of people have barn cats, as Alan said, keeping the rodent population down in the barn. Is there a utility there?
Well, barn cats in Wisconsin, of course, are not, for the most part, owned pets. They're usually not given veterinary care. They're not usually given a lot of food. And indeed, when we surveyed a lot of farmers and we asked them why they had so many cats on their property, basically, they just said, well, they're there, just like the pigeons and the starlings that are in the barn. Unless we actively go after them, the numbers just increase. They just keep coming. So as Alan said, you know, unless you do control them, some of these farms in Wisconsin had dozens of cats living essentially, you know, centered on their farmstead.
I want to ask you about what Alan said at the end there, that his family shot the cats that came, who were above the number that they wanted at the barn. We also got a caller who couldn't stay on the line, who said, as a hunter, he said he shoots every feral cat that he sees while hunting. He added those cats have decimated some of the hunted bird populations. Is that a solution, shooting cats? I mean, a lot of people are going to say that that is not a humane solution to this problem. What do you think?
Well, it's an interesting sort of legal and ethical question, and it really became an international incident, really, in Wisconsin 10 years ago when our Conservation Congress is this annual event in every county in the state in which the DNR invites people to come in and either comment on things the DNR is doing or suggest things that they think the DNR ought to do. And there was a proposal made that a question, really, of why doesn't Wisconsin treat unowned free-ranging cats the same way that most states do, and that is to have them legally declared an unprotected animal, which would put them essentially in the same category as mice or rats or pigeons or starlings, an exotic, non-native, invasive species. And what that would mean essentially is that the state would have no particular interest in how you controlled them, as long as you didn't break any other laws, as long as you didn't do something that amounted to animal cruelty, as long as you didn't discharge a firearm in the city limits or some of the other things that might be involved. But most states do have laws on the books that list animals like free-ranging feral cats as unprotected animals.
And how does it work out in those states?
Well, it's obviously not a solution to controlling cat numbers because cat numbers are increasing everywhere. So it's not a common occurrence and certainly doesn't happen frequently enough to control cat numbers.
Let's go back to our callers. I've got Ted with us next in Manawa, I think it is. Ted, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what did you want to share?
Well, I have a number of bird feeders and bird houses, and we have cats that come and try to get the birds. And for years, we've had bluebirds nesting in our bird houses, but for a few years there, the cats have been killing them, and now the last 3-4 years, we haven't had any bluebirds. So I don't like stray cats.
All right. Thank you, Ted. And bluebird's a rare bird, one that a lot of bird watchers I know are excited about seeing. So is that typical, I guess, of what happens when you've got cats interacting with some of these other species?
Well, when we were doing our research in rural Wisconsin, we were not only studying the cat populations, but we were also studying the bird populations around rural homes and farms. And what we knew about the hunting ranges of cats that ranged outward from the barn or the rural home and how many birds they were likely to have access to in that area, we estimated that about 10% of the birds that live within the hunting range of these rural free-ranging cats get killed by cats every year. That's not an insignificant source of mortality, especially for some of these birds that are having a pretty rough time because of other problems like habitat loss.
Well, Ted, thank you for the call, and we're going to go next to Jason in Oak Creek. Jason, hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What did you want to share?
Yeah, recently me and my family were in the Philippines, and it's very heavily populated there, and they like cats. Some of them do. Many of them learn to hate cats, and so there's a lot of cats out on the street. They get really scrawny and feral, and you really notice that the absence of wildlife, especially around the cities and the villages. And the cats actually turn out to compete with the humans they'll sneak into houses and steal food because there's no wildlife available to hunt.
Jason, thanks for the call. Talking about his experience in the Philippines, sounds like you've seen this in action, huh?
Well, actually, he brings up a really interesting case. Cats have probably had, unquestionably had, their most terrible impact on wildlife on islands around the world.
New Zealand.
Especially tropical New Zealand, Australia, many smaller islands around the world, especially the ones that are in tropical and subtropical climates, where they really do have large populations of truly feral cats, as well as the commensal cats that the caller saw in cities. And indeed, if you look at the irreparable damage that cats have done to wildlife, cats have been the cause of at least 33 bird extinctions around the world, most of them on islands. And they threaten, cats are one of the main threats to another 142 species that are on the endangered species list, many of them on islands around the world.
So, Stan, this is a tough nut to crack, and we're not going to do it by the end of our time together, but in our last 30 seconds or so, how should we start going at this problem?
Well, I think there are probably three things that we need to do. First, we need to control the cat overpopulation. We can do that through responsible pet ownership, which means keeping your pet cat indoors and controlling its reproduction. We can certainly do things about removing cats from sensitive natural areas where they interact with wildlife that are of great conservation concern. And probably, you know, finally, we should change our societal attitudes toward free-ranging cats and regard them the same way that we regard domestic dogs.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Stanley Temple, Professor Emeritus in Conservation in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and a Senior Fellow of the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He and his students have studied the impact of free-ranging cats and what that impact is on wildlife in rural Wisconsin. And we want to know what you think. You can let us know your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. Coming up, we'll learn about Madison 365 Academy, an effort to help recruit and train the next generation of journalists here in Wisconsin. First, we're taking a look beyond the Midwest and into the southern part of the states for this week's Food Friday. For anyone that's a fan of comfort food, we'll have everything from classics like mac and cheese to fusion flavors like curried and fried cauliflower. Lazarus Lynch joins us now. He draws on flavors from the American South and around the world. He's a chef, and you can catch him online and on TV, where he calls himself the son of a Southern chef. We've got some recipes posted, including some of his videos on the Central Time Facebook page. You may know him from his work on Taste Made or the Food Network. Lazarus, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me. It's great to talk to you.
Well, clearly family is an important part of your cooking heritage. You're the son of a Southern chef, as you say. What did you learn from your parents? What's their background when it comes to food?
Sure. Well, so my father, absolutely, family's incredibly important to me. My father was a chef from Alabama, so he grew up learning how to cook from his mother and his grandmother, who were both phenomenal cooks and housekeepers and beauticians. And so my father was always very connected to soulful cooking, and he learned it in the South, and he moved to New York City when he was a little boy and lived here, worked in his own businesses, and finally opened up a restaurant in his latter part of his career. And my mother is actually from Guyana, so north of Brazil, from South America, and she lived there for about 13 years, and when she was 13, then moved to London and stayed there for quite a while. She stayed there probably over a decade and then moved to New York City, met my father. They lived in the same apartment complex and then got married, and they had me and my other brothers and sisters. So family has always been a very, very big part of where food comes from for me. My mother, obviously being from Guyana, I experienced a lot of Guyanese food, and I also experienced foods that were traditional in in Europe, you know, such as the pork sausage rolls, and tea was very popular. Every day we drank tea. And then obviously my father, who was from the South, mac and cheese, fried chicken, catfish, you name it. It was in our household every single day. It was a part of our culture. It was a part of who we are. So for me, family is an incredibly important part of what I do. And it's an important part of celebrating food. And that's what I do every single day.
I'm just trying to picture what family dinner looked like in your household growing up, because that's a lot of influences there.
Absolutely. It could be, you know, family dinners are interesting. During the week, it was pretty simple. You know, my mom did most of the cooking. My father was an entrepreneur, so he owned retail stores. He owned 99-cent stores, and then finally the restaurant, which was his last business. But my mother was pretty much the matriarch in terms of creating the food for the household during the week. And it was very, very simple things. Spaghetti and meatballs, really Americanized foods. And every now and then she would do something like a saltfish or codfish served with rice, or something really, really humble like a corned beef out of a can that she would flavor up and spice up. Because the truth is my parents didn't have a lot of money, and so they had to make every little bit stretch and feed four hungry children. So my mother really made it work. And on the weekends, specifically on Sundays, it was really like Thanksgiving. My father would create everything from his macaroni and cheese to his coleslaw, which was passed down from his grandmother and great-grandmother, collard greens, and the like. And so Sundays were really, I guess, the most important dinner days for us in terms of the quantity of food that was prepared.
When did you know you wanted to go into being a chef and preparing food and inventing food in a lot of ways?
Right. Well, you know, it wasn't until my dad opened the restaurant when I was 10 years old that I started to think of food as a career. My father had always cooked. He cooked with us all the time. I remember when I was probably 7 years old, my mother had gone on a trip and she took my brothers and sisters with her, and I was home with dad. And I remember it being like 12 o'clock at night and my father waking me up saying, "Hey, do you want to go in the kitchen and cook something?" And that memory of creating something at midnight with my dad as a young kid really, I think, stuck with me even until this day. It was always about connecting with my father. And so that's how I viewed food. And when my father opened the restaurant, I saw it as a way for him to make money, and I saw it as a career opportunity. And quite frankly, I just loved the rush of a kitchen. I love the urgency of making large pans of whatever for customers. And so I worked with him in the restaurant. I did everything from stock the shelves to ring the register up, restock sodas, to helping him peel veg. I mean, you know, if he needed the help, I just did it. And I fell in love with it. My siblings and I, we were sort of my father's first employees. And I was the one that stuck with it, and I fell in love with it.
We're talking to Lazarus Lynch, a.k.a. the son of a Southern chef. We've got some of his recipes. We've got recipes and videos linked on the Central Time Facebook page. I want to get into one of those now, get us a little hungry, Lazarus. Macaroni and cheese, okay. Everybody's had that. You've got macaroni and cheese with Gouda, and that's one of the recipes we've got up there. Why A, it sounds awesome. B, why Gouda?
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. Everyone's had mac and cheese a thousand ways. And I thought, I want to do something a little bit more interesting. Growing up, we've always had mac and cheese very traditionally. My father used about 4 to 6 cheeses, but they were cheeses that you could find in your grocery store. I worked at a cheese shop when I was in Buffalo, New York for college. I went to Buffalo State College. And I worked at this cheese shop, and I learned about every kind of cheese. And Gouda was actually the cheese I fell in love with the most. I thought it was just such a brilliant flavor. It was complex. It had a lot of different flavor profiles that could be paired well with many different things, including sweet foods like pears. So Gouda for me was an idea to let me try to jazz up this standard classic mac and cheese that, as you said, everyone already has had in their life, and do something a little different. Now, what was great about the Gouda that I chose to use was that it actually had a marbling of bacon, which was smoked.
Whoa.
So the Gouda itself was smoked, and there was bacon throughout the whole pound of Gouda. So, I mean, you're talking about comfort food at its highest, right?
Big time. And I'll say, Lazarus,
comforting.
I love Gouda, but I just eat it. You know, maybe on a cracker or with bread or with an apple or something like that. I don't know that I've ever cooked with it. Any secrets to making it, you know, work well, make a good the cheesy sauce in the mac and cheese?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I do a classic mac and cheese. Well, first of all, I make macaroni and cheese many different ways. Sometimes I will do just a bechamel sauce, which is a classic French sauce, one of the five mother sauces. And so what you can do is melt some butter and add some flour, basically equal parts flour to butter. Get that nice and cooked down. Add some milk. Add the Gouda or the Gruyere or whatever you're using. Grate it up. And it becomes this delicious cheese sauce. And I really find that when you melt the Gouda cheese, it just has this really nice, luscious quality to it. It stays really pure. It's a great melting cheese. It's also, like you said, it's a great cheese to pair with a cracker or an apple or a pear, things that are classic like that. So the way that I prepared it in the video doesn't use the bechamel method. It's actually a method my father used, which was using eggs, so large eggs, and carnation milk out of a can that you whip together, and you add a little bit of melted butter in that, season that up with salt, pepper, and garlic powder, and add the cheese to that, and it melts inside of the oven. So there are tons of different directions you can go with the melting cheese effect, but Gouda is a great, great choice for melting cheese.
And this Gouda mac and cheese, I think a mac and cheese is a side dish a lot of times. What would that go well with?
Well, you know, Gouda mac and cheese, really, you can eat it by itself and be quite happy. But
sure,
if you wanted to pair it with something else, you could totally do a collard green. I love to do a combination of kale greens and Swiss chard and collards or turnip greens. I've got a great turnip greens recipe on my website and social channels. So it goes really well with those kinds of things. And also, people love to eat it with a piece of chicken, piece of roasted chicken, or a piece of fried chicken, or a piece of barbecue chicken, or barbecue ribs. So macaroni and cheese is one of those delicious, comforting foods that you'd be happy to eat it by itself, or happy to eat it next to a salad to make you feel a little bit more balanced about it, or go right all in and just go comfort all the way with some fried chicken.
Now, we're in Wisconsin, of course. We're familiar with our cheese here. Let's go to one we're not as familiar with. We're not in grits territory in Wisconsin. And another link we have up on the Central Time Facebook page is to your shrimp and grits recipe. First of all, for a Wisconsinite who hasn't encountered a lot of grits in my life, give me grits 101. What is it? How do you cook it?
Sure. So, you know, grits is a very interesting thing. I was actually having a conversation with a fellow Southern cook about the difference between grits and polenta, for example. So I grew up on a white classic grit, and grits are cornmeal that you know, that are grind down, and it's traditionally a little bit finer it's less fine than your traditional polenta or yellow cornmeal. So it's got a little bit of a grit taste. And so a delicious way to cook it for me growing up is we did milk or water, a combination of both, or stock. And you add a little bit of grits. Once you bring that to a boil, you add a little bit of the grit, a little bit at a time, until it gets nice and thick, and then you finish it with butter, salt, and pepper. So as a kid, I always loved a sweet grit. I just didn't like the savory grit. So the way I like to think about grits is the thing you eat for breakfast. Polenta is the thing you eat for dinner. And, you know, polenta is a great substitute for grits. I, in fact, make it all the time. But I don't think sometimes people equate a yellow cornmeal to a white cornmeal as a grit. So I like to think of them as one and the same, but have different flavor variations. But that's a very standard way of making a grit. I love adding a little bit of heavy cream in there to give it a little bit more body and give it a little bit more luster, if you will. Those are grits. And it's really, really delicious with shrimp, as you know, is a very classic Southern dish, shrimp and grits, salmon croquettes, which my father prepared all the time with some grits on the side with a little bit of butter on top. So it really goes well with seafood. And I think the Southerners really love to put grits with their seafood.
I'm talking to Chef Lazarus Lynch right now about some traditional and contemporary Southern-inspired cooking. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you from the South, or is your family? What are some of your favorite food traditions from there? Maybe ones that you're trying to help pass on here in the Midwest. Call in with your favorite recipes. How do you like to cook, serve, and eat mac and cheese or grits? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a lot of links to recipes that Lazarus has up, some recipes, some videos along the way, too. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on Southern-style cooking with a twist. We've got Lazarus Lynch with us, and we want you to join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your favorites from the South. Is there a food that you miss if you're from there, that you enjoy if you've traveled down there? How do you incorporate those flavors into your cooking here in the Midwest? Maybe you have your own way of putting an international spin on your favorite comfort food. We just heard about that Gouda macaroni and cheese. Do you have your own way to jazz up the traditions like mac and cheese? Are you a fan of grits? Do you have questions about how to cook Southern-style food for Lazarus? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Lazarus, you are adapting some of your dad's recipes, among other things, from the South, and you're looking often at international influences. What kind of things do you like to try to mix in with the traditional Southern cooking?
Yes, and, you know, international food to me is brilliant, and it's like learning about your friends next door, because really I think food brings the world together, and I love every time I have the opportunity to experience a different culture. So I lived in China, in Beijing, for 3 months in 2011. I was there doing a study abroad internship, and I fell in love with Asian cuisine and Asian flavors. So I oftentimes find myself picking up a bottle of sriracha, or I'll find myself in the grocery store buying some kimchi just to have on hand. And so I decided, you know what, I'm doing a lot of the Southern food. Why don't I try to pair these two cuisines together? Very different, very unusual, but let me see how this goes. So I decided I was going to use a classic rib. My father made ribs a lot. So I was going to take a rib, pair it with some honey and miso. And what I got out of that was a miso honey rib, which is just delicious. And that's on my YouTube channel. You can watch the video. But that is a really, really delicious way of bridging flavors together. Another thing is jerk chicken. Many family members of mine are from Jamaica, and jerk chicken is really popular in Jamaica and other parts of the Caribbean. So what I decided to do was to pair that jerk chicken flavor with ramen noodles. I worked at a Japanese restaurant making ramen. That was my only job to do every day, was to make those noodles. And so I decided, why don't I pair those flavors together? So I think it's a unusual, unexpected way of approaching food, but it definitely does speak to my heart when I think about the food I love to eat, the food that brings me back to a place I've lived in, or a place I traveled, or the people that I love. So really, there are many different ways that I do that every single day, but I love to surprise people with those international fusion flavors.
That sounds great. Let's go to one of our callers now at 800-642-1234. Colin is on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Colin, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Colin, or ask us about?
Well, two quick questions. First of all, I was just going to ask for a general recipe. I know you just mentioned salmon croquettes. Well, I was wondering how much different that is from, like, your traditional fish cake, like a salmon cake or crab cake, and maybe just kind of a general recipe. Then the other question was, I wanted to ask if he has ever put ketchup on his mac and cheese.
Ketchup on mac and cheese. Let's start there and then move on to our salmon croquettes, Lazarus.
Yeah, let's start the ketchup on the mac and cheese. Thanks, Colin, for your questions. So I don't put ketchup on my mac and cheese, but my family puts hot sauce on their mac and cheese.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
You know, it's a very classic thing to do. It's like the Beyonce song, "Have Hot Sauce in My Bag." I mean, my brother literally carries hot sauce with him in his book bag. It's just a thing that we do. So, but my family in Europe loves to put ketchup on literally everything and anything. So I think to each their own. I personally just have it straight up, you know, mac and cheese, nothing else. For croquettes, though, really good question. So a salmon croquette and, you know, crab cake or salmon cake, very, very similar. Both use a binder, which is egg. So it helps it to stay together and form into the shape of, you know, the patty. But with a croquette, you know, you're frying it on both sides, just as you would with a salmon cake or a crab cake. But the texture of the meat is a little bit different. So, you know, with a croquette, it's usually a little bit flatter. You're usually pan frying it on both sides. And you're usually using some kind of cornmeal or some sort of flour. With a salmon cake, it's a little bit thicker. It's literally, you know, more cake-sized compared to a croquette, which is generally a little bit flatter. My father used to hand-shape his salmon croquettes in his hand, and my father had pretty large hands, so it was probably about a 6-inch diameter salmon croquette. But a really easy recipe, if I can just give it to you in 30 seconds,
sure,
is you take salmon in a can, remove all the bones, you add bell peppers, red bell pepper, green bell peppers, chop them up very finely, a little bit of onion grated, and then you're going to also add some garlic powder, some salt, and some pepper. You can use 2 eggs to bind it together, and then just crate them into patties, and then you want to form them into the rounds, and then dredge them in some self-rising flour, a combination of self-rising flour and cornmeal, yellow cornmeal, and then just pan fry it in some canola oil for about, you know, 4 minutes on each side, just until both sides are golden brown and crisp. And it's a very, very easy and delicious salmon croquette.
Hope that helps, Colin. We're talking to Lazarus Lynch, a.k.a. the son of a Southern chef. A lot of recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to our callers with Pat in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Hi. Yes, here's a question on making fish. I drove in Tennessee one time, and at a small grill in the country, I had the best fried fish I've ever had. I asked the cook how she makes it, and I think she just said flour, ordinary things. But she said it turns out best on a dry day. It depends on how much humidity there is. So my questions are, do you agree with that, and what is your favorite preparation? Is flour and cornmeal the best, or do you have a lighter breading?
Pat, thanks. Fried fish, big issue here in Wisconsin, Lazarus. Go for it.
Okay. Here's your 911 fried chicken. You know, my father made fried chicken every single day at his restaurant.
Ooh, fried fish she's going for. I'm sorry.
Fried fish. My father made fried fish every single day at his restaurant. He served it with his tartar sauce and on 2 pieces of bread, and people loved it. And, you know, I agree that the humidity can affect the way that the fish is cooked. But what I would do is I like to pat it dry. Once I wash the fish, I pat it completely dry, and I use a combination of self-rising flour. It's really important that you use self-rising flour because it has baking powder inside of it, so it helps it to be a little bit crisper on the outside. And I season that with some Old Bay seasoning, or you can use some paprika, some garlic powder, salt, pepper, some rosemary, oregano, and some thyme. And I use that. I dredge the fish on both sides. And my father used to fry it in soybean oil. And if you don't have soybean oil, you can use a vegetable oil. You can use a corn oil. You just want an oil that has a higher smoking point, such as a soybean or a peanut oil, for example, which has a higher smoking point. So that just means that it can stay hotter at a consistent temperature for a longer period of time. So you can cook a lot of fried fish back to back. And that is, you know, and then once it comes out, you drain it and put a little bit of salt on the top, and it's delicious.
Thanks for the call, Pat. Time for one more quick call from John in Caledonia, Minnesota. John, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
I had to pull over. I just had their comments. I'm a certified executive chef living in Minnesota, but I've had the pleasure of living in Fort Worth, Texas, and Richmond, Virginia. So south and south, they don't combine. But the people up here just don't know the great flavor of the ground sassafras, the gumbo file, as they call it up here. I mean, I've made some incredible soups and some different gumbos and all kinds of great southern New Orleans dishes that just people just don't have it up here. They just don't get it.
John, thanks a lot. And Lazarus, briefly, as we wrap up, you're trying to help us spread the love there in New York and now here to us in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think Southern cuisine is one of those cuisines that brings people together. It's all about family. It's all about comfort food. It's all about communal styles of eating. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do here in New York City amongst my generation, millennials, and also try to spread that everywhere that I can. So it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, Rob. And thanks for sharing time.
And real quick, Lazarus, maybe your next experiment. What are you going to try combining next?
You know, I've been thinking about combining, doing something with sushi, because I love sushi, and perhaps pairing that with something Southern. Haven't quite figured it out yet, but that's to come.
I think deep fried okra in a sushi roll sounds really good to me.
Oh, that's, there you go.
Boom.
That's it.
All right, Lazarus, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much.
That was the son of a Southern chef, Lazarus Lynch, sharing some classic and contemporary Southern recipes with us. You can see some of his recipes, actually a bunch of them, on the Central Time Facebook page or at WPR.org. Let me run through. We didn't get to curry cauliflower fritters with cilantro yogurt sauce. We've got a link to his, I think, a video on that one. He's got a fried fish sandwich. He talked a little bit about that. And some Dr. Pepper sesame ribs. So if you're wondering what you're going to cook this weekend, look no further. Find some links at WPR.org or on the Central Time Facebook page. While you're on the Facebook page, if you have a love of Southern cuisine, think it's underappreciated up here in the Midwest, we'd sure like you to tell us about that, too. Again, that's on the Central Time Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.